and welcome once again to EWTN's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keck, your host, our guest author and old friend, Father Dwight Longenecker. His book, There and Back Again, A Somewhat Religious Odyssey, published by Ignatius Press, naturally available through the EWTN Religious Catalog, EWTNRC.com for all things Catholic. Always a pleasure to speak with
you. Good to see you again.
We tried to get together during the summer at a conference and get the book done, but we weren't able to get it. So it was great that we were able to work this out. There and Back Again, A Somewhat Religious Odyssey. Why is it somewhat?
Well, a good number of converts have written their stories, and they make for inspiring reading and very instructional reading regarding the theological points of becoming a Catholic from the Protestant denominations. And I'd covered a lot of that territory in some of my other books, so I wanted to write a more personal story, an autobiography, but also tell my conversion story. So therefore, right, somewhat religious, not totally religious.
Right. Now, in the beginning, you use a quote by St. John Henry Newman, God has created me to do him some definite service. He has committed some work to me which he has not committed to another. I have my mission. I may never know what it is in this life, but I shall be told in the next. Do you have any inkling now, or are you still not sure what your mission
no,
is?
No, I think I'm one of the lucky ones in that it came clear to me what I should be doing and what God's call for me was. Mm-hmm. And I referenced St. John Henry Newman because, right, as an Anglican convert to Catholicism, and also a lot of people may not realize this, like me, he was actually brought up in an evangelical Protestant home. Mm-hmm. In his youth, he used to go out and hand out tracts and so forth and do very evangelical type things. And so he's always been a great influence on me, and I wanted to use that special quote, which is very moving, there at the front of the book.
Right. You actually, and Steve Ray, well known to EWTN, of course, wrote like a foreword to it. And it's interesting because later on you talk about this, the importance of the famous Jack Van Impe.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And Rexella, of course. Yes. And that announcer had a fabulous voice. But it was important to your family growing up, wasn't it?
Yeah. When I was growing up, this would have been in the late 60s, early 70s, Jack Van Impe was actually out as a traveling evangelist. He would come to churches and do his evangelistic rallies, speaking in churches, and visited our church a couple of times. I think he went on from then to have a significant television and radio
Absolutely.
Ministry. But at that time, he was still out on the road preaching and teaching mm-hmm. in various churches.
Right. And you break down, actually, your various journey, basically by the towns or areas you lived in different
That's
times
right.
in life, right?
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting, too, because one of the things Steve Ray points out that he explains, he says, you explain serious matters in a lighthearted manner that makes them enjoyable and equally understandable. Why did you decide to take that approach?
Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, I wanted the book to be entertaining and a good read, and most people said, yeah, I couldn't put it down. It was really interesting and it was fun to read. And also, but for a more serious reason, I realized in my writing, especially in learning how to write fiction and drama, that there are certain things which open the human heart. Music opens the human heart. Tragedy and pathos and compassion opens the human heart, but humor also opens the human right. heart. When a person laughs, they let down their guard. Mm-hmm. When they laugh and see a joke, they're actually open to the truth. And so, what do they say? Many truths are spoken in jest.
Right.
Well, therefore, I wanted to use some humor to sort of keep things light, but also to keep the reader's heart open to what I was trying to say.
Now, in the introduction, you talk about the fact that many times people had come to you about your conversion story, when are you going to write your book, etc. And you said, I was always been flattered, but joked, I haven't written it because too many of the guilty are still living,
yes.
including you.
Yeah, that's right.
What did you mean?
Well, as the story unfolds in the book, you'll see that there are a good number of people who profess to be Christians, but actually are hypocrites, and they stumble and they fall, mm-hmm. and they have sin in their lives, which is one of the realities of trying to follow the Lord Jesus, that we're all sinners. And I'm in that club as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried not to make the story especially overly pious or overly sort of, that's why I say somewhat religious.
You tried to write at one time that you something, right, that you decided was overly pious, right? And
yeah,
you kind of trashed it.
I was inspired by Thomas Merton's famous conversion story, and
okay.
probably also by John Henry Newman's, which are very religious.
Right.
And I began writing it, and after two or three chapters, I gave up because it was
it was too
religious, if you see what I mean.
Did I misunderstand?
Too overly serious about myself.
Did I misunderstand you were alluding to Merton? Do you think he became a Buddhist in the end?
he did end up as a, well, not as a Buddhist, but he certainly...
He was heavily into Buddhism,
yeah,
right?
He was heavily influenced by Eastern religions in the end.
Yeah, yeah. I figured that's what you were relating to. Now, you say I'm essentially a private person. I'm an introvert and always been expert in donning a mask. What's the mask you always wear or used to wear? Because your masks change over time.
I'm really interested in the psychology of religion and the psychology of religious people. And I'm aware that, well, when I'm a priest, I have to put on the priest's uniform every day. Mm-hmm. And when I celebrate Mass, I put on all my vestments. And therefore, we have to assume the costumes and therefore the persona of a religious person and a pious person. And I hope I'm serious about my faith, and I hope I'm pious to in the right way.
Right.
But this can sometimes become a mask for people where their insecurities and their sinfulness is hiding behind that mask or that uniform, and that's a serious trouble.
Well, you're unusual because your parents went to Bob Jones University, and you did too. Are you still a snob?
I hope not.
Because the girls seem to accuse you of being a snob at the time,
right? There's a story in there. When I was at Bob Jones, I came down with a serious illness called Anglophilia, which is the love of all things English. Mm-hmm. I was interested in the arts. I was interested in England. I was interested in poetry and all that sort of thing. And in my college years, I guess that turned me into a bit of a snob. At least I was perceived that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the stories in the book about when I was at college. I was entered into one of these date auctions. Right. And when my name came up, all the girls in the school said, "Ooh, he's a snob." And I'm afraid they were right.
No, there was some nice girl who liked you who bid $2 for you, I believe, as I recall. It's interesting, too, because the church that you belong to, it was kind of an independent evangelical kind of church or a fundamentalist church. And then when you got tied into Anglicanism, that was kind of an odd group, too, right?
Yeah, that was the first sort of jump into the world of tradition and liturgy and the historic church. While I was at Bob Jones, we were permitted to go to a little church called the Holy Trinity Anglican Orthodox Church. And this was part of a breakaway Anglican denomination, which had been founded in, I guess, the late 1960s.
Okay.
And we were permitted to go there because the founder was a friend of Bob Jones, and one of the people who was on the board at Bob Jones was also a member of this little church. So we were allowed to go to this Anglican church, and that's where my Anglophilia, or love of all things English, sort of clicked into high gear.
Right. And you were actually born in the States, right? In Pottstown?
Oh, yeah. I was brought up in Pennsylvania.
No, but I mean, people hear you speak and they think, well, you must have been born in England.
Yeah. I don't think my accent's so English anymore, but certainly when I was over there, it went pretty English.
Right.
Yep.
It's English enough.
I think it sounds that way still.
You can still hear it. It's interesting, too. So is the United States a shire and England Mordor, or is it reversed?
Well, the title There and Back Again refers to Tolkien's book, The Hobbit. And in The Lord of the Rings, of course, which is the sequel to The Hobbit, the hobbits go to Mordor, and then they return to the Shire.
Mm-hmm.
And Mordor is the land of evil. So There and Back Again in the Tolkien legendarium means going from the Shire to Mordor and coming back again.
Okay.
Well, my shire, therefore, must have been the USA, and Mordor must have been England. But in many ways, of course, that's back to front, because England is like the shire.
Right. That was the idea, right? You say we are not to put our tent pegs in too deep. What do you mean?
Well, my story has been one of going there and back again, moving from one place to another and following the Lord's guidance and the Lord's leading. And this is one of the themes that has really motivated me in my spiritual life, seeing the spiritual life as being a journey, that God chooses a tribe of nomads at the very beginning, that Abraham and his family are travelers in the wilderness. Moses leads the people out of Egypt through the wilderness to the Promised Land. There's always this sense of moving on, and not putting your tent pegs too deep means I'm not going to stay in this place too very long. And that's also a metaphor for our spiritual life, because we're going to die one day.
Right.
And therefore, this life here is always temporary. We're not to invest in the worldly things too much.
It kind of always reminds me of the Transfiguration. Hey, let's hang out here, build tents. Nope.
Yeah.
Is that how it works? You're being prepared to do something else.
Yeah, you need to go back down the mountain and get real.
That's why you were here,
so
you could deal with what you're going to deal with.
Yeah.
You have some great stories about your grandparents and your parents. I thought you say that Grammy Keene was an absolute brick. What does that mean?
That's probably an English reference, which is creeping into my story. Okay. An absolute brick in England means a solid, dependable, sturdy, reliable, loyal sort of person.
In chapter two, when you're in Ridgewood, you say you use the quote from Tolstoy, "All happy families are alike. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way." You said, "I think our family was happy, but we were certainly not like every other family. In fact, I learned pretty early on that we were very unlike every other family. In fact, we were weird." One of the things, I guess, that was kind of weird was the fact that you didn't have a TV, right?
Right. And here I am sitting in a TV studio.
Right.
And my mom chose not to have a TV for our family. And as kids, we didn't think too much about it, except we kind of grated against it when we went to visit friends and family, and they did have TV. We'd sit down and we'd be all goggle-eyed and watch the TV the whole time. But I'm grateful for that now because we read a lot.
Right.
We had lots of books. We went to the library every week, and Mom made sure that we had lots of reading material, and we read and read and read again.
Well, you can watch Mr. Ed and reruns now, so you can catch up on stuff you missed out on. Now, you talk about having this kind of supernatural Twilight Zone-level experience with your family in a car, and the idea that it was important to you and your family because you believed in miracles. Explain.
Yeah. You know, all through my life, right from the age of about three or four, I've experienced some really remarkable, I suppose, miracles or mystical experiences, wonderful things that have happened. And one of those was actually not something that I remember, but which a story my parents told.
Okay.
They were coming home from the youth group that they were leading, and Dad was driving the station wagon, and me and my older brother and sister were asleep in the back. They put the seats down, we were asleep in the back. And he's coming down a lane with steep banks on either side, a narrow country lane. And he goes over the crest of a hill, and he sees another car coming at high speed in the other direction. And they knew that as they went down to the next dip, that driver would not be able to see them. So there was no place to go. So they continued on, and my mom says, sure enough, the car came over the brow of the next hill at high speed, and we saw in our headlights the terrified face of the other driver as he was prepared for the head-on collision, which would certainly have killed all of us.
Yeah.
And then my mom and dad said, it was like they don't know what happened, but my dad looked in the rearview mirror and saw the other car's taillights receding down in the other direction. It was like the two cars had dematerialized and gone through one another without actually any damage being done. And this was an extraordinary miracle, which my parents would relate to us as kids and to anybody who was interested, where we were spared from almost certain death by a wonderful miracle.
Right. Part of the mission, like you say. I do know that there's a providential plan, as we alluded to before, in this world that we can only see partially. And you talk about a keyhole in paintings by people like Rubens. What do you mean? Explain.
Yeah, the question comes up, therefore, if your family was delivered from this terrible accident, why isn't every family delivered from a terrible accident? I tell a story earlier about my grandfather who died when a coal truck crushed him, and he was taken to hospital and died soon after.
He saw angels, right?
And saw angels when he passed. Another beautiful miracle story, but he wasn't delivered from death. And so I'm trying to explain this mystery, and I'll say I think it's because we only see things partially.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like we're looking through a keyhole onto some vast and wonderful panoramic painting of, say, a great battle or something. But through the keyhole, we can only see part of what's going on. We can't see the whole scene.
Yeah, through a glass darkly sometimes.
Yeah,
people would
say. So, and maybe that's a good title for a book, Through a Keyhole.
Right, there you go.
Yeah.
Now, what's the deal with T.S. Eliot?
Yeah, in that chapter when I talk about our family being weird, I talk about some of the weird experiences I had as a child. Because we read a lot, my dad had bought us one of those sets of the old World Book encyclopedias. Mm-hmm. You might remember them.
Sure.
With their green and white bindings. We had the whole set on the bookshelf. And every year we would get the World Book Annual, which came out in, I suppose, sometime in the summer, summarizing the events of the previous year, news-wise. And so I'm about 9 years old, and I can still remember clearly reading the obituary of T.S. Eliot, who died in 1965, and reading how he went to England, became a poet, lived over there, and I thought that would be marvelous to be able to do something like that. I would love to go and live in England and be a writer.
Right, that's key. Now, did you actually win the Presidential Physical Fitness Award?
No, I'm afraid not.
When you were in Shillington, no?
Presidential Physical Fitness Award was something which was started by President Kennedy.
I remember.
And it was all the kids in schools in school had to perform certain physical fitness requirements to get them physically fit. You had to throw a softball and climb a rope and do so many push-ups and so forth. I don't think I did.
No, you weren't. That wasn't really. You talked earlier a little bit about the idea of hypocrites, and I thought this was the way you said this. You said they were not hypocrites at all because our religion taught us that we were all sinners, meaning the people who fell. What was really hypocritical was to pretend we were not sinners, ultimately.
Yeah. I think that sums it up. You know, as a young person growing up in the faith, you invariably come across church leaders and the people who are supposed to be the good Christians who stumble and fall. Mm-hmm. Maybe they fall into sins of the flesh, maybe they fall into embezzlement of money, whatever it is, they actually stumble and fall, and they're not the good examples that you wish they were.
Right.
And so as a young person thinking about the faith, you've got to deal with that. And the way I dealt with it was realizing that actually our faith said that we would be sinners and we should expect that. It's a case of wrong expectations. Furthermore, I looked in the mirror and I realized I was a hypocrite too. So the real hypocrites are the ones who pretend that they're not hypocrites.
Right.
Okay, because we're all
hypocrite is basically an actor, somebody
who's
putting
like that,
on.
It's like that old joke when the man says to the priest, "Father, I don't go to your church, it's full of hypocrites," and he says, "Well, why don't you come along anyway? We can always make room for one more."
Yeah, Bishop Fulton Sheen was classic for using
those lines. Is it one of his?
Lines.
Was it? Okay.
Now, I don't know if he created it, but he used to say it. I was happy to learn in the early age that it was possible, in fact, it was necessary to distinguish between Christian religion and Christians. It was necessary especially to distinguish between the flame of faith and the keepers of the flame. And I thought that was interesting, too, because later on, as we jumped to your time at Oxford and Cambridge, and when you actually became an Anglican priest and the bishop who ordained you later had his own problems, didn't he?
Yeah.
Bishop Peter, was it?
Yeah, Bishop Peter Ball was a very charismatic, very charming person, and I believe in his heart of hearts really wanted to be the monk that he pretended to be.
Right. Okay.
Or that that persona that he assumed. There again, we're talking about the mask or the costume. He wore his monastic robes. He presented himself as a Franciscan type of monk, but he was later jailed for molesting young men.
Right, he had a kind of a strange thing that you talk about in the book. We don't have to go into about dealing with young men and anointing them and things like that.
He had a program where they would, guys who were about 18 who had just left high school would spend a year, 6 months in his monastic community, and then he would send them out to parishes in twos and threes to live simply and to serve in the parish. It was a great idea, and lots of lives were touched and changed by it. Mm-hmm. But within that sort of intimacy or close relationship with those young men, he was misbehaving.
All right. Now, you talk about, to jump back to the Bob Jones University, you talk about the idea of, in fact, you got involved with smuggling Bibles into Eastern Europe, right?
Yes.
I found myself plunged into a reform school discipline and a dating scene that was a blend of The Little House on the Prairie and The Scarlet Letter, because you had been a little freer in the non-denominational kind of experience. You talk about the concept of laying on hands having different meanings for different people, right?
In my high school years, I had a job, I had a motorcycle, I had a girlfriend, I had my parents gave me a fair bit of freedom. But when I went to Bob Jones, there was a lot of discipline and a lot of stuff. Discipline, a lot of it was good, but a lot of it was very focused on boy-girl relationships, and it was very strict, and that's why I say it felt like a blend between The Scarlet Letter and The Little House on the Prairie. Mm-hmm. The girls were demure and modest, which is good, but wasn't much excitement there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they strictly regulated all the relationships, which had its good points,
right.
But it was also very restrictive compared to the high school years that I'd had, where I'd had a fair bit of freedom.
Right. Okay. In Oxford, you talk about being there. I said, I soon realized that the evangelical wing of the Church of England was practically Presbyterian in every way. The theology, most of the Wycliffe men, was a mild form of Calvinism. And you said they were Anglicans because they considered the Church of England, quote unquote, the best boat to fish from. What does that mean?
Well, I went from Bob Jones over to Oxford and studied at Wycliffe Hall, which is an evangelical or a low church Protestant.
Because there's like three versions, right?
Yes.
There's high, broad, and low.
Yeah, and the low church is part of the Church of England is very Protestant in its theology and in its churchmanship and in its worship. So some of the pastors, for instance, in the Low Church, Anglican Church in England, wouldn't even wear vestments. They just wear a suit and tie to officiate at their services. Mm-hmm. Not the Eucharist, but at their morning prayer and evening prayer services and so forth. So it's very low, and that's why I say it's practically Presbyterian in every way. Mm-hmm. But they were evangelical, so they were concerned with winning souls. They were concerned with evangelization.
I see. That's
therefore,
the reference.
And therefore, they considered the Anglican Church, the established church, to be the best boat to fish from.
Well, were they fishing to attract other Anglicans to the Low Church, or were they looking for people like Catholics or others outside there to bring them in?
Both.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I discovered that the theology of most Anglicans was a pleasant form of agnosticism that seemed at first glance to be no more than a mild, polite syncretism.
Yeah, St. John Henry Newman uses the word latitudinarianism. Mm-hmm. And latitudinarianism is basically the, heresy in which a Christian group will accept almost any difference of opinion as long as you stay within the group. Mm-hmm. And Anglicanism is like that. It's latitudinarian. You can be low church and practically Presbyterian. You can be high church and practically Roman Catholic. You can have elements of Orthodox spirituality. You can have elements of charismatic worship. You can have almost anything within that as long as you stay in the boat.
Right. Now, you had this experience as well where you trekked across Europe. And this is in the section on Jerusalem, but you say, I not only sensed the companionship of my guardian angel, but I grew in my understanding acceptance of the Blessed Virgin Mary. Why?
Well, by this time I had, within the Anglican Church, become much more Catholic in my understanding of the sacraments and my priesthood, and also began to appreciate devotion to the Blessed Virgin. I'd gone to Walsingham in England, and I'd gone to Core Abbey on the Isle of Wight, which is dedicated to the Blessed Virgin Mary. Someone gave me a rosary. Mm-hmm. So in 1987, after my first job as an Anglican priest, I had 3 months free. And so I therefore made a pilgrimage from England to Jerusalem, hitchhiking and staying in Benedictine monasteries all across France and Italy and so forth.
Were those Catholic monasteries?
Oh, yeah. Right. And as I walked along, I would pray the rosary so I began to have a much deeper appreciation for the Catholic right. Church and for the Rosary and for the Blessed Virgin.
And I know you visited one particular church, I forget which one it was, because you always talk about the feeling of God's presence in your life, and then you went into this Catholic church and you felt a greater, even greater presence.
Yeah, this was in the summer after my high school graduation. Mm-hmm. I went with an evangelical mission team to Europe to smuggle Bibles into the Eastern
right.
Europe.
Okay.
And at the end of the trip, we were stationed in France, and then at the end of the trip, we took a bit of a tourist trip to Paris before mm-hmm. flying home again. And all the rest of the kids were wandering around the streets of Montmartre in Paris. And there, of course, is the great Basilica of Sacré-Cœur to the Sacred Heart. Mm-hmm. And it was a summer evening. They sat on the steps there and overlooked the city lights of Paris. Mm-hmm. I went into the church, and for those who know the church, it's actually a place and has been a place for centuries now of perpetual Eucharistic adoration.
Oh, okay.
They have a great huge monstrance in there for Eucharistic adoration.
Yeah, you didn't realize quite what it was at the time.
I didn't know what it was. It was just a beautiful big church. It was dark, and there were candles, candlelight everywhere, and I just sat there in the silence but felt God's presence. And I didn't know what it was that I was actually there for.
You say 2 years at King's College, right, opened my eyes to the reality of the Church of England. The Dean of Chapel was a modernist theologian who wrote books with pretentious titles like The Dazzling Darkness. You say that he epitomized that quip from the English sitcom Yes, Prime Minister, that the perfect Anglican clergyman was a blend of a socialite and a socialist. While the Dean was an urbane theologian, the college chaplain was an open homosexual, and invitations to clergy meetings in Cambridge always included invitations for everyone's partner, quote unquote.
Yeah, that pretty much summed up the Anglican religion in Cambridge at the time. This is Cambridge. After I was at seminary in Oxford, I had a job as an assistant priest in a parish in Sussex in the southeast of England, and then this is when I did the trip to Jerusalem, and when I came back, I began as a chaplain in Cambridge, and that pretty much sums up the religious temperature in Cambridge at the time.
You say the fanciful understanding of Anglicanism as a form of Catholicism is still very popular among certain Anglicans. this idea that the Church of England was independent of Rome from the very earliest days when good old Henry VIII broke with the Pope. He was just restoring the ancient Christian church in Britain that had always been independent of Rome. And then you go on to say Anglo-Catholicism is surely one of the most attractive fabricated forms of Christianity. That's pretty tough.
Yeah, I guess it's a pretty severe judgment, but Anglo-Catholicism has is the more Catholic expression of Anglicanism. And when I say that it's the most beautiful fabricated form of religion, mm-hmm. they've taken Catholic spirituality, they've taken the beautiful buildings in England, the beautiful ancient Catholic buildings in England, the churches and the cathedrals. They've maintained a beautiful musical tradition, a very beautiful artistic tradition, a very beautiful and intellectually aesthetic theology. And so they've put this all together into a very, very attractive form of Christianity, one which is very seductive. It was seductive to me and seductive to any young person who's thinking about the faith and looking at the faith and looking for liturgy, looking for beauty, looking for history, looking for tradition.
Right. Smells and bells, sometimes people would say, would attract people.
But it's largely a confection. It's a gathering together of all these beautiful things, if you like, treasures which actually are part of the Catholic Church, but they've sort of picked and chosen the things they like best and kept it.
Right. It's got this tradition, almost like a museum.
Yeah, it was interesting, for instance, when I became a Catholic, I realized there was like 500 years of Christian history which was a blank to me from the 16th century onward, because the Anglicans had no appreciation or didn't really value some of the great saints of the Counter-Reformation, some of the great spiritualities of the Counter-Reformation. So the Jesuits and St. Francis Xavier, St. John Bosco, and so forth and so on, were just not on their radar at all.
Okay, as far as your radar, another book in the works, or what are you thinking about?
Yes, but I'm a bit stuck right now.
Okay.
So I'm actually focusing more now on writing fiction and drama.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
So I'm working on a comedy which is called Arsenic and Church Lace.
Okay, okay. I like the original one. I hope I like this one as well. Thank you for
Thanks very much,
Father Dwight Longnecker. Of course, the book there and back again, a somewhat religious odyssey, worth the checking out. It's published by Ignatius Press, available naturally through the EWTN Religious Catalog. I'm Doug Keck. We appreciate you joining us right here on EWTN's Bookmark. Thank you.